Ça ne vous a pas échappé. Ça fait 10 ans que les attentats du 11 septembre ont eu lieu et on va s'interroger un petit peu sur l'impact. Qu'est-ce qu'il en reste au bout de 10 ans? Est-ce que ça a modifié leur écriture, leur perception des choses? Est-ce que ça a modifié leur science-fiction concrètement, cet événement qui a changé la face du monde? Donc on va pouvoir en discuter. Et pour en discuter, donc nous allons commencer par la dame de ce plateau, Jeanne Adebas. Pour citer quelques romans hein, de Jeanne, il y a Eden en sursis, La Ballade de Trash, Plaggers, le dernier chez l'Atalante, et également La Vieille Anglaise et Le Continent. Juste à côté d'elle, vous avez Norman Spinrad. Pour citer quelques titres, hein, il y a bien sûr Rêve de fer, Le Printemps russe en direct, ou alors Bleu comme une orange. Et puis il y a aussi Il est parmi nous, et on parlera de son dernier roman, Oussama, notamment. À côté de lui, Jess Moreau. Jess Moreau, c'est la trilogie Jéhovah, mais c'est aussi le dernier chasseur de sorcières. Et vient de sortir il y a quelques mois L'apprenti du philosophe. Là aussi, on va pouvoir en discuter. Et puis le dernier membre de cette table ronde, Ian MacDonald. Ian MacDonald avec Brasil, Roi du matin, Reine du jour, ou bien encore l'excellent Le fleuve des dieux. Donc là aussi, on aura sans doute beaucoup de choses à dire. Une première question à faire, peut-être un petit tour de table déjà, savoir comment est-ce que il y a 10 ans, ils ont vécu le 11 septembre en tant qu'humains, mais aussi en tant qu'écrivains, en se disant, tiens, là, il y a un événement tellement fort que ça change un petit peu ma manière de voir les choses, ou du moins, ça m'interroge. Alors, on va peut-être commencer par Jeanne, il y a 10 ans.
Alors, il y a 10 ans, je l'ai vécu avec un temps de décalage par rapport au reste du monde, dans le sens où ce matin-là, j'étais en train d'écrire justement mon premier roman et je n'avais pas cours, enfin je ne devais pas travailler avant 2 heures de l'après-midi. Lorsque ça a été l'heure de partir, j'ai tout éteint, je suis partie, je n'écoutais pas la radio, j'étais dans ma crypte, tout se passait bien, le monde était normal. Et puis j'ai mis mon Walkman, parce qu'à l'époque c'était des Walkman et pas des MP3, et je suis partie joyeuse vers ma classe. Puis dans la rue, il y avait une atmosphère tout à fait étrange qui m'a frappée assez vite. Les gens se parlaient beaucoup. Il y avait des attroupements autour de certaines vitrines, et notamment celle du vendeur de télévision, juste à côté du métro. Ça m'a vraiment étonnée, cette façon de bouger qu'avait la foule. Alors je me suis arrêtée avec les gens qui étaient coincés devant la vitre, et là j'ai vu un avion rentrer dans une tour que je n'ai pas identifiée tout de suite. D'abord, elle était dans un tel état qu'elle n'était pas identifiable. Si bien que je me suis dit, mais où est-ce que c'est ça? Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé? Donc j'ai enlevé mon MP3 et j'ai entendu les gens parler. Et c'était ça, le 11 septembre pour moi. Après, je me suis retrouvée en classe avec un vide total. Je sentais qu'il se passait quelque chose de fondamental, mais je le mesurais pas. Voilà.
Tu disais que tu étais en train d'écrire le matin. Est-ce que le lendemain matin, tu as pu continuer ton histoire normalement, ou d'un seul coup, là, cet événement a fait que ça a tout changé?
Pas sur ce roman-là et pas à ce moment-là. Il m'a fallu un temps pour intégrer l'information, mais effectivement, j'ai écrit ma troisième nouvelle 3 semaines plus tard, et la fin de cette nouvelle s'encastre dans les tours du 11 septembre.
Il y a eu un impact,
Fort, oui.
un impact fort. On en discutera un petit peu même question pour vous, Norman. Comment est-ce que vous avez vécu l'événement, et en tant qu'écrivain, d'auteur, est-ce que vous vous êtes dit, là, c'est plus pareil d'écrire de la même manière?
As fate would have had it, we were very, I was very close to the event. I was there on 9/11 on 9th Street in Donna's apartment, and I woke up to the actual event. I didn't quite see it from the window, but when I ran down to the street, I saw it. Well, anything that changes the present is going to change what you write about the future. As I found out with Russian Spring, which turned into a uchrony before it was published. So it was a, I think the world changed very drastically. in many ways. And I was thinking about this morning. You see a lot. There's been a lot of science fiction written about the fictional World War III. This is World War III. It's taking place all over the world. It's taking place in America, 9/11, in Spain, in England, in Somalia, in Yemen, in Indonesia, among other places. At the moment, this is a kind of World War III, which is not like the other two wars. It's very different. Doesn't seem to have much of an end. So I was asked by Libération to write something right afterwards, which I did because they were doing a special issue. And then a year later, I was also back there, and Libération asked me to do another one. And people were then asking me, well, why don't people, a lot of writers were trying to write novels somehow about 9/11. I even started something, which was no good, because they were writing about their own reactions to the event. And when people asked me why I wasn't trying to write a novel about it, I said it's too soon. That's not what I'm interested in writing about. And finally, I decided to try and write what I thought was going to be a short story or a novel at longest from the point of view of a terrorist, this is what turned into Osama, because I felt that, among other things, what was happening, that the Islam was being demonized, that people, but also it's the old Rolling Stones song, Sympathy for the Devil. And I wanted to write something from the point of view of an Islamic terrorist who is personally likable, but what he is doing isn't. So I got about 20 pages into it, I realized I was writing a novel. I realized it was going to be very hard to get this thing published. So I wrote it without a contract, which is not my usual thing. It still haven't been published in the States because it was something I felt compelled to write because nobody was doing it, really. And I found out why nobody was doing it. But it often, the thing that you have a great difficulty being published that nobody else is doing, maybe for the same reason, is something that has to be done because the world really changed, and it's still in process. This war is still going on in one way or another. You don't even have to call it a war. It's a clash of civilizations. It's very science fictional in that matter. It's one style of consciousness against another, and the two are very alien to each other, and they demonize each other, and they affect each other. And I was thinking this morning, the fact of the matter is that even though he's dead, Bin Laden kind of won, because when Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union, he said, said to the Americans, "I'm going to do a terrible thing to you. I'm going to deprive you of an enemy," which he did, but it wasn't so terrible. But what Bin Laden said was, in effect, and not the same way, "I am going to destroy American liberties." Although he didn't say it, "I'm going to create the great Satan." And to a large extent, he succeeded. He started this war. He's responsible for every time you go through the nightmare at the airports you go through now, Homeland Security, which I like to call in a mixture of German and Romanian, the Heimat Securitate. It really sounds like what it is. So it's impossible to write anything about the near future or even further that is not affected by this clash of civilizations, which is affecting the whole planet now.
Jasper.
The day after 9/11, that is to say 9/12, via the internet, all of us who are in the Writers Union, Science Fiction Writers of America, were invited to post our reactions on sci-fi.com, the sci-fi channel's website. We could post political rants, we could post poetry, we could post short stories. I found myself spontaneously writing a short story called Apologue. An apologue, c'est un type de conte avec une morale. Apologue, I could only have written it within 48 hours of 9/11. I couldn't. I agree with Norman. Once you get, you'll never get enough perspective on the event, I think, to write really compelling fiction. I think we're at least within a year or so. We're much too close to it. Apologue is about the famous movie monsters who savaged New York City throughout Hollywood history. So King Kong appears on the scene in Lower Manhattan, and the Radosaur, the dinosaur from the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, the Ray Harryhausen movie, he shows up, and Godzilla from the Roland Emmerich dreadful remake of the original Japanese masterpiece. That particular Godzilla shows up, and all of these monsters offer to help clean up the city. They ferry survivors across the East River and across the Hudson River away from the site of the disaster. So the theme of the story became, as I was writing it, the tension between the harmless fantasy of science fiction movie monsters and the lethal fantasy of theistic religion.
Ian MacDonald, en tant qu'anglais, comment est-ce que vous avez vécu et qu'est-ce que ça a changé?
It's slightly more complicated than that. I think what the sense I got on the day of 9/11 was it was this massive explosion of irrationality into the world, and it has continued ever since. Irrationality has ruled for 10 years now, both in the radical Islamist mindset and the Western response to it as well. We live literally in a mad world at the moment where no sane or rational decisions are being made. And what I can remember watching on the television was these planes coming out of the sky, and it may be the same for other people here, but you didn't know when they were going to stop. I was in the office, actually, in my day job, and a woman I worked with went to the toilet. She came back and said, "What's happened?" And said, "They've just hit the Pentagon." And there was that sense of you didn't know if it was ever going to stop. These planes would just be coming out of nowhere. And it, in a sense, it was kind of the day that kind of madness took over. Now, I've lived all my life, actually, in Northern Ireland. And so with 30 years of terrorism, we're kind of prepared for this. You know, it's kind of a good upbringing for life in the 21st century. In that we had all those security limitations, we had all those searches. We had actually much more stringent searches on aeroplanes than anything that's been happened recently. In the early 1980s, on aircraft from Northern Ireland, they would wrap your luggage up in plastic don't know why they thought that would stop it exploding or something, but it was, yet again, it was an irrational response to, in a sense, an irrational outburst of violence. So, kind of, anyone from Northern Ireland, you know, getting searched, restrictions on freedom, we're kind of used to that by now, actually, so we're kind of not that surprised. But at this place, at this point, I will take my clothes off, because, just a second. Because we're living in a world where this T-shirt 11 years ago would have made no sense whatsoever. It shows a Native American, and it says, Department of Homeland Security, fighting terrorism since 1492. And 11 years ago, that would have made no sense whatsoever. But nowadays, I can't wear this through an airport or I will get arrested. So in a sense, it's a beautifully irrational response to... to a beautiful, well, it's a beautifully irrational happening.
Alors, Ian MacDonald, les autres auteurs présents ont écrit tout de suite ou très peu de temps après, ou ont commencé à écrire sur le 11 septembre. Est-ce que vous avez fait la même chose ou pas du tout?
No, it wasn't my disaster, in a sense. I'm kind of more interested in writing about the world in which 9/11 is a kind of a fixed focal point that kind of changed history. I'm interested in writing about that world, but the actual event itself, it's kind of not my story to write about. Now, that's never stopped me writing other people's stories at any point, but I just didn't feel I had anything particularly valid to say about it. But I do find that, because I tend to write stuff set in the near future, and I do find that it's very much shaped the way I think about near future science fiction.
Jeanne.
J'entends Yann dire que ce n'est pas son désastre à lui. Je pourrais dire la même chose, ça n'est pas mon désastre à moi, mais ça n'est pas vrai. Parce qu'en fait, je suis professeure dans des milieux où il y a une présence maghrébine très forte. Et que jusqu'au 11 septembre, j'ai vraiment cru que la France, que l'éducation nationale allait intégrer ces gens-là. Qui était venu chez nous. C'était mon boulot, c'était ma vocation. Et j'ai mis 15 jours à comprendre que là, c'était fini. En fait, que la chape de plomb allait tomber, qu'il y aurait une vague terrible d'islamophobie qui allait déferler sur la France et qu'elle ne s'est jamais arrêtée et qu'elle continue encore. C'est d'ailleurs le sujet de la nouvelle que j'ai faite. Finalement, pardonnez-moi, Norman, James, les Américains, votre traumatisme, j'en avais pas grand-chose à faire, que pour une fois l'Amérique se prenne dans la figure le résultat de ses actions, c'est, comment dire, s'il y avait un dieu, ça serait logique. Et Yann l'a très bien montré tout à l'heure. Mais là, j'avais des élèves pour qui j'avais de l'espoir, jusque-là. Pour lesquels tous les jours, mes collègues et moi, on se battait jusqu'à essayer de concilier leur mode de vie originel et les nôtres, jusqu'à organiser une journée de la jupe. Vous savez, c'est un film qui a eu lieu en qui a été tourné en France et avec Isabelle Adjani. Et c'est un prof qui traque et qui prend en otage ses élèves. Mais la journée de la jupe dans mon collège, avant le 11 septembre, c'était ça. C'était tous les profs en jupe, y compris les garçons, mettaient des kilts, bon, ils trichent un peu, pour faire comprendre que nos gamines avaient le droit, sans être des putes, de se promener en jupe. Et à partir du 11 septembre, cet anniversaire que nous observions tous les ans depuis 3 ou 4 ans, il est tombé. Ça n'a plus jamais été fait. C'est ça, moi, mon traumatisme du 11 septembre. Et c'est ça que je raconte dans ma nouvelle qui s'appelle Monument.
Une petite question pour Norman et pour James. Le fait d'écrire sur le 11 septembre, ça participe d'un processus pour vous approprier l'événement, prendre de la distance, le digérer, ou est-ce que c'est plutôt un processus sur la manière dont vous voyez le monde après? Alors, il y a deux choses différentes. Norman a écrit un roman un petit peu plus tard et James a écrit tout de suite après. Lequel des deux veut répondre?
Well, it's really complicated changes. That took a long time to think about it. But there is a fundamental difference that is at the root of this whole business, and that is that in the West, in France, in Germany, in the United States, democratic countries, we believe that the legitimacy of a government is derived from the consent of the governed, from some kind of democratic voting decision. This is the core principle of a liberal democracy. The core principle of an Islamic state is that legitimacy derives from the Quran, which is unchangeable by the vote of the people. And what's more, that liberal democracy in which the will of the people can supersede the will of Allah is evil. They think liberal democracy is evil. We think that what they do is evil. These are two fundamental different definitions of good and evil. And this ultimately, and there's another aspect to this, which in a different way, I wrote in an earlier novel called The World Between, La Grande Guerre de Bleu et de Rose, how does a democracy deal with an attempt, with a situation where there's an enemy or even an internal politic which believes that multiculturalism and democracy is wrong, and if they take over, it's the end of democracy. But how does a democracy deal with something like that without losing its democratic ethos itself? And we're right in the middle of this. It's gotten very bad in the States. And in France, it has to do, and in Germany, we have a large Muslim population. This is the question. Can there be such a thing as a multicultural culture which includes an Islamic point of view and a liberal democratic point of view? Islam, and one of the reasons I did write Osama, I would like to see it published in places where it's never going to be published probably, in Arabic, is that we are confronting this, I think, in the West. We're confronting it in our fiction. To some extent, we're beginning to, at least in science fiction. But I don't think that the Islamic culture is confronting this at all. The Arab Spring seemed to have been about that. But now you see what's happening, that the Islamists have won the election in Tunisia. Turkey is becoming more Islamic. Whatever is going to happen in Syria. This, in a way, said this war began with 9/11, but in a way, this fundamental philosophic, political, theocratic conflict goes back a lot further than that. It goes back at least to the Crusades, which, if you think what they were about, was bin Laden, the Christian version of Islamic terrorism. And then the Islamic reaction to it. This, in a sense, is a 1,000-year war. This is and the way these two ways of looking morally, spiritually, theologically, politically at the world, this could end up being Joe Haldeman's forever war, because I don't see... I think that liberal democracies have an ethos of a politics which can accept multiculturalism, including Islam. But Islam doesn't have that, at least not now. So I don't see any conclusion to the, it's not thesis, antithesis, you know, synthesis. So far, there doesn't seem to be any avenue to synthesis between these two cultures on our singular planet. And I don't see where it's coming from.
Just more.
Didn't I see a cover for your novel Osama in the program book? Is it
French cover?
Yeah. So it's been published in French. Oh, well, let's have that fact get around. Yes, let's go snap it up. Can we buy it in the librairie?
You can buy it there. You can buy two editions of it there. You can buy the expensive Fayard trade edition, which I prefer people buy.
Okay.
And you can buy the reprint from Chez Lou with two different covers.
And Norman will sign it.
You can
for
have
it.
Both. You can have both covers, and I will sign them both at the same time, gladly.
Yeah, I'd have to say, after doing my little story about King Kong and the Ratus or the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and Godzilla coming to New York on 9/11, I then really wanted to extract the whole thing from my consciousness as much as possible, not out of denial, but out of disgust. There was a fetishizing. This is going to sound unpatriotic. I'm really very patriotic in my own sort of crypto-Marxist way. This is going to sound unpatriotic. There was a fetishizing of 9/11, all out of proportion, for my money, to what actually occurred. Ian made the really good point. Far worse disasters have occurred on American soil than those attacks on the Twin Towers and
such as the
genocide of the Native Americans.
Yeah, but it wasn't all at once.
Was not all at once, but it was a disaster nevertheless. The concentration camp conditions under which blacks lived in the antebellum South, the era of lynchings that occurred after the Civil War. For my money, these were genuine crises. And the myth-making that kicked in right away, the notion that we should regard all the policemen and firemen as great heroes. I've heard from several sources that the firemen and the policemen did almost as much harm and maybe more than good on that day, that they were largely in the way of the evacuation. The heroes of that day were the people on Flight 93 who brought down the jetliner that was intended to crash on the White House. They were going after the White House. David Brin makes the point, I think a pretty good one. David Brin was a guest here, I think, about 5 years ago. So what really worked on 9/11 was not any infrastructure the government had in place. It wasn't any official policy for dealing with disasters of this type. It was individual citizens empowered by technology, particularly cell phones, who organized some of the evacuations from the Twin Towers, but most dramatically, most memorably, the decision to bring down Flight 93 before it could hit the White House. The men who went to the cockpit and confronted the terrorists and fought with them knew from their cell phone conversations with their wives what was really going on.
Well, I've got to amend some of this, because that is all true, but I was there, very close there, and believe me, first of all, there wasn't hardly any possibility of evacuating. It wasn't evacuated. People were jumping off the building and killing themselves. They had a choice between burning to death or falling down and dying that way. Firemen went into that building. Policemen went into that building as they were coming down to try and drag people out. Believe me, not 100% of these people were heroes, but a lot of them were killed trying to save people. It's not true. Not true that, that you know, the government couldn't do anything about it. But one thing that's different by 9/11, we were there, and I guess it was in the whole country. Certainly it was in New York. The only thing that was on all the channels of television was coverage of this event for days. And they showed those buildings being knocked down, I don't know, 10 times an hour. You had it bashed into your brain. The images were just pow. I don't know if you got that in Ireland, but it was pow, 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 pow. It's nothing else. So it got imprinted visually, literally, on everybody's retinas over and over and over again. And a disaster that you're right about, you know, what happened, slavery, the Civil War, for that matter, that happens over time, is easier to get away with in a way than the impact of something that happens in a moment, and then with the new technology, the moment is pounded into your brain over and over again, while as you're sitting there watching television obsessively, because you don't know what's going to happen next. We're sitting outside the day after having lunch in a cafe, and there are jet fighters circling New York, some of them European, and you're in an American city being circled by jet fighters, and you're glad they're there. It's like a very, very, very bad acid trip.
Okay, well, I stand corrected on the point about the police. I do know that there was at least one case of a very systematic evacuation, because one of the CEOs whose people were in the building had rehearsed in the event of such a disaster. I think your point is very good, Norman, that you made earlier, that in a sense the terrorists won beyond the success of bringing down the towers. Due process was denied in an unconstitutional fashion for years afterward. The Arabs, people of Muslim background, who were locked up at Guantanamo Bay, and that, I think, was Osama bin Laden's real victory.
Jeanne, tu voulais réagir?
Ah, comment tu as vu ça?
Parce que tout à l'heure, je t'ai vu prendre le micro.
Il y a quelque chose qui m'est apparu pendant que Norman parlait. Il faisait une comparaison entre les deux conceptions du monde américaine et qu'on va dire coranique. Moi aussi, il y a quelque chose qui m'apparaît, c'est que tu parles de deux mondes absolument, qui ont au moins un point commun, c'est qu'ils ne sont pas laïcs. Et que ça, c'est un point commun entre les États coraniques et l'Amérique. C'est un point de convergence qui m'a toujours fait très peur. Voilà.
Ian McDonald, vous vouliez ajouter quelque chose?
Yeah, I was just thinking that in some ways, the West, what happens in the West, is actually in some ways a sideshow to the real big battle, which is between the two schools of Islam, between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam. And for every one Westerner who dies as a result of Islamic terrorism, that kind of general blanket term, 30, 40, maybe 50 Muslims are killed on either side of the sectarian divide. And in a sense, that is the big fight, and I think will be the big fight in the not-too-distant future. It is Saudi Arabia versus Iran across the Persian Gulf. And in a sense, if we have, and they are very fundamentally different schools of Islam all the way back. They hate each other even more than they hate the West. It's like Monty Python, the Holy Grail. You know, Monty Python, the Life of Brian. You know, it's the Judean Popular Front hate the peoples from Judea much more than they hate the Romans, kind of thing. But in a sense, that's the big fight. It could end up, you know, nuclear armed Iran facing off against oil-powered and oil-rich Saudi Arabia. And if we have problems with fundamental Islam, they are of our own making, in that our dependence on Saudi oil, which continues, in fact, grows ever greater, it's our dependence on Saudi oil, putting money into Saudi Arabia, into the extremely conservative society there. All those shiny mosques, when I was researching the Dervish House, in Turkey, that every neighborhood has a nice shiny mosque with a nice shiny dome on top. And that Saudi money has put that there. And it's Saudi money that's building the new madrasas and religious schools there as well. And it's Saudi ways of thinking, you know, that are being, you know, that are being promulgated, because for them it is the war against Shia Islam. That's the big one. It's not the war against the West. It's ultimately it's sectarian warfare, and we're just on the edge of it.
Well, I have to say something about that too, because that's true as far as it goes, but Iran and Saudi Arabia don't agree with a lot of things, but they agree on one thing, and that is, you know, the absolute rule of the Quran. That they are both fundamentalist societies. I mean, you're the so-called Islamic Republic, which the Iranians approved is a contradiction in terms, versus the Saudi theocratic Sunni dictatorship versus the Iranian theocratic Shia dictatorship. They agree, unfortunately, on one thing, that Western liberal democracy is evil. It's evil. They regard us as evil, just as we regard their phallocratism and their absolutism as evil. That's what they agree on. The geopolitics of it is absolutely true, what Ian is saying. And there's, of course, another aspect to it, which makes it even more complicated, which is Arabs versus Persians. And they hate each other for that reason. Not that we in the West are all brothers across the borders either.
A quick footnote. I was talking to a soldier recently back from Afghanistan, and his impression, being one of the boots on the ground players in this tragedy, is that it's not primarily the Quran from which that culture derives its philosophy, but it's various commentaries on the Quran.
The Sharia.
Yeah, the Sharia. That's even more important. Let us not, before we go home, before we leave the discussion, of course, the other way in which the terrorists won beyond their wildest dreams is George Bush and Rumsfeld then decide they can go to war against Iraq, which, you know, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with, you know, training those pilots. They were Arabian. And completely ignoring the finding of Hans Blick from the United Nations that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Baghdad and environs. And, of course, that crisis is still going on, and as well as Afghanistan.
James Moreau, petite question, parce que si on voit bien dans Oussama le lien direct, entre guillemets, entre la situation mondiale et qui dérive du 11 septembre, est-ce qu'il y a un lien dans des livres comme L'apprenti du philosophe? Est-ce que c'est un livre qui est marqué justement par cet attentat et le monde qui en a découlé? Essaye de voir l'influence que ça peut avoir.
Well, I agree with Ian that the world became a sort of welter, a cauldron of irrationality, ideologies taking the place of thinking. And like all James Morrow novels, I guess the Philosopher's Apprentice is a celebration of the Enlightenment. I mean, philosophy, if you break it down into its etymology, it's the love of wisdom in the sense of open-ended conversation. What is the critique I make of the Muslim world is that owing to the Quran and Sharia law, the great post-Enlightenment conversation gets shut down. We can no longer discuss it. Allah has spoken, the revelation to the prophet settles it. Of course, we have the equivalent of that kind of fundamentalism in the United States. But, you know, I'll keep grinding my axe until I keel over one day in front of the word processor, that the Enlightenment came along just when we needed it. I mean, Europe was in flames with a holocaust of witch burnings in the late Renaissance and the period we now call early modern Europe.
Well, you know, Islam is a little bit more complicated than that. There is a discussion, you know, the Quran is the basis. This is the word of Allah. The Sharia, well, the Haditha, see, the thing about Islam that's unique, Jesus Christ never became the general and the emperor of Christianity. Muhammad did. So Muhammad was both the prophet and the ruler. So the Haditha was, in effect, the rulings of Muhammad on political and legal matters, which were not the words of Allah, and the Sharia was case law built on top of that. So they have plenty of intellectual arguments about the meaning of Sharia and the Haditha, which are ultimately interpretations and expansions on the Quran. So they do have their intellectual discourse, but it's coming from a different root.
It's not secular.
No, it's
rooted in the supernatural, ultimately. And I think that's a big problem.
Je voudrais ajouter que la charia, telle que l'a décrit Norman, ça n'est pas la loi de tous les musulmans. Nous connaissons les chiites, nous connaissons les sunnites, mais il y a également les alévis, par exemple, qui ont une vision de la vie en commun, notamment avec leurs femmes, qui est totalement égalitaire, qui ne remet pas en cause leur droit à l'héritage, au divorce, que cette frange de l'islam est parfaitement libertaire, j'allais dire libérale, c'est un très mauvais mot, et qu'elle est très peu médiatisée parce qu'elle n'est pas evil. On ne la connaît pas, celle-là. Et pourtant, ils sont nombreux, notamment en Turquie. Voilà.
Une petite question pour Ian MacDonald. Je pense notamment au fleuve des dieux. Dans ce roman, est-ce qu'il y a des ramifications, tout le moins des conséquences du 11 septembre, peut-être simplement sur la société que vous mettez un petit peu en scène?
Oh, yeah. it's a while since I wrote the book, so I'm trying to remember what happens in it, but... I mean, I initially pitched the book in 1999, and I was kind of doing some early kind of background whenever 9/11 happened. And the thing about India is the second biggest Muslim country in the world. Indonesia's number one, India's number two, purely by dint of India having such a vast population. And there always has been, and has nothing to do with what goes on in the West, but there has always been massive interreligious war between Muslims and Hindus, and frequently Sikhs as well, in India. And the terrifying thing is that these kind of outbursts of violence, the most... I don't remember the name of the city, but... The ongoing one in North India is where a mosque, which had been there for quite a long time, a thousand years or so, was demolished, so a temple to the Lord Ram could be built on top of it. And this kind of, I mean, there were multiple deaths, and if I remember rightly, bits of the mosque were tossed into the river and things.
The temple to who?
Rama. Yeah. Yeah, the Lord Ram, but certainly, I use it as an example of these spontaneous outbursts of religious irrationality that happen in India, and you know, and people slaughter each other On the next street, in the next house, they burn each other out. And then when it's finished, it all goes back to normal again. And it's as if it never happened until the next time it happens. And that's something that's very kind of hard for us. Maybe in kind of the Judeo-Christian kind of setup, you know, where we have long memories for things, and there's a concept of forgiveness and forgiving and forgetting. In India, they don't have that so much. There isn't a concept of forgiveness. Things just go back to the way they were, knowing that it may happen again. But that religious strife is completely separate from the one that from Islam in the West.
Well, there has certainly been a history of slaughter in the name of different understandings of the Christian message, you know, the 30 Years' War. Perhaps there's been more forgiveness. I don't know. There better not be any forgetting, though.
Alors, il nous reste une petite dizaine de minutes. Est-ce que vous avez des questions dans la salle? Une fois, deux fois, trois fois, Jeanne, pardon.
Je voudrais me raconter un truc. Avant la conférence, là, je suis allée sur Internet pour me rafraîchir la mémoire des faits de ce jour-là, les faits en Amérique. Et j'ai donc ouvert mon moteur de recherche et là, sont tombés des milliers d'informations totalement intraitables, à aucun niveau. Je ne pouvais pas décider quel document était valide et lequel ne l'était pas. La paranoïa est absolue et totale sur le 11 septembre. Le traumatisme est tel qu'on ne peut pas trouver facilement d'informations fiables sur cet événement. Comme si le martèlement qui en a été fait tant au niveau télévisuel que cinématographique, et même nous, et même Roland Wagner avec La Saison de la Sorcière, puisque c'est un de nos écrivains de SF qui a traité le sujet. On a tellement martelé ça que ça n'a plus de sens, finalement. Cet événement qui a changé le paradigme mondial, bien, de façon bien plus profonde, finalement, que la chute du mur, dont l'anniversaire du mur de Berlin, dont l'anniversaire est tombé hier. Donc cet événement a tellement marqué qu'on n'arrive pas à le traiter intellectuellement, en fait. C'est le refuge de toutes les folies, de toutes les théories du complot. Je ne serais pas étonnée qu'Elvis Presley soit pour quelque chose dans le 11 septembre. Voilà.
T'as l'impression qu'on n'a pas encore digéré l'événement, et notamment en matière de science-fiction ?
Ah, ça me paraît évident, mais notamment au niveau mondial. On est encore en train de process.
Ian MacDonald.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, James is talking about 9/12, the day after. And on 9/12, I did something so very bad, for which I'm going to go to hell. A guy I used to work with in a production company, we're in the office at 9/12, we went online, and he said, look up the website for the Windows in the World restaurant, which was the restaurant at the top of one of the Twin Towers. And the website was up, and it said, make a booking. And we made a booking, and we're going to go to hell for that.
I look forward to seeing you in hell, Ian. Do you play chess?
Norman, est-ce que vous avez l'impression que la science-fiction a encore beaucoup à traiter avec ce 11 septembre?
Will I do any more? I don't know what I'm going to do in the future. I mean, that part of it is finished. I wrote about the Hajj. I wrote about the difference between Islam and terrorist Islam. So in that sense, I don't think I'm going to repeat and do a sequel to that or something like that. But I don't think you can write anything in the near and intermediate future without dealing with, because the future grows out of the present, out of the past, and out of your present, and you certainly can't avoid this. You're not going to write any more stuff about the Soviet Union, probably, or Nazi Germany in the future. You can do it, I suppose, but that becomes a uchrony. It's like, it's one of the things I don't like. I mean, this is an aside. It's why I'm not interested in steampunk. Steampunk seems to me to be a, you know, a failure of imagination and vision. You know, go back to the past and write Victorian stuff as if nobody invented the internal combustion engine or something. I don't see the point in this. Maybe you do it once. Somebody does it once. That's the whole thing. So to write about the near future or even the medium-term future as if 9/11 never happened, as if this situation we're in now, where we've had so far a 10-year war with no end in sight, hadn't happened, is writing a silly kind of irresponsible uchrony in the future. There could be such a thing as a uchrony in the future somehow, as I discovered with Russian Spring.
Jan, tu voulais... Non, oui. Une dernière question ou une petite question pour nos invités? Oui, monsieur là-bas.
Oui, je voulais en revenir. Tous les gens qui contestent la version officielle du 11 septembre sont très vite estampillés de théorie du complot, quoi. J'ai l'impression qu'il y a là quelque chose d'assez systématique, et jusqu'à refuser même à que des enquêtes soient faites sur le déroulement officiel du 11 septembre. Alors, je me rappelle que dès que les tours sont tombées, on aurait trouvé un passeport quasiment intact dans les tours qui appartenait à un Marocain. Enfin, il y a eu des choses absolument hallucinantes. Et qui ont été, dès que les gens se sont un peu appuyés sur ce genre de choses pour dire il y a l'anguille sous roche, ah ça y est, c'est des complotistes, de très vilains conspirationnistes. Et je voulais savoir s'il y a des auteurs qui ont traité de ce sujet.
Y a-t-il des auteurs en science-fiction qui ont parlé de la théorie du complot ?
Alors, des auteurs de science-fiction qui parlent sur la théorie du complot, il doit y en avoir. Mais c'est pas comme ça que je voulais répondre, si tu permets. Personnellement, moi, ça ne m'intéresse pas, les théories du complot. Je laisse ça à Dan Brown. Il adore ça. Ça serait tellement bien si le monde était si simple que ça. Si on pouvait rêver que les États-Unis, par exemple, ou n'importe qui d'autre, aient une organisation si puissante qu'ils puissent maîtriser ce genre de choses. Parce que là, on pourrait agir. On aurait des choses, des gens envers qui ou contre qui nous tourner. Malheureusement, le monde n'est pas si simple que ça. C'est juste un assemblage d'incompétences, de malentendus, de mésorganisations, de façons de voir le monde totalement décalées. Un peu que lorsque l'armée française a envoyé la cavalerie contre les panzers en 1945. C'est exactement la même chose, la défense américaine par rapport aux Twin Towers. C'est exactement ce type de non-compréhension du monde moderne qui s'est passé. Alors que de 12 allumés aient envie d'y voir des mains sombres telles celles du docteur Fu Manchu, moi je veux bien qu'on fasse toutes les enquêtes du monde et qu'on accuse, je ne sais pas, Elvis Presley de l'assassinat de Kennedy. Mais bon, il faut arrêter, il faut être un peu raisonnable et savoir que le monde n'est pas gouverné par une main noire derrière tous les dirigeants.
Gérard Klein, une question.
I would just say very quickly, I like the maxim, if it exists, there is pornography of it. And I feel the same way about conspiracy theories. If it exists, there's a conspiracy theory of it. But I think such theories risk trivializing the truth of it.
Je vais vous révéler une grande vérité.
Ah mon Dieu.
Il y a un groupe ultra secret dont j'ai fait partie il y a longtemps, il y a prescription, qui invente toutes les théories du complot.
Ça te ressemble bien, tiens ça.
Gérard Klein, auteur et éditeur. Une dernière question, on a encore 2 minutes, 180 secondes. Une fois, deux fois.
Ah, attends, il y a sur Internet un jeu à mourir de rire qui a été fait par les Japonais, qui s'appelle la théorie du complot en kit. Et donc, vous avez des tas de petites figurines avec les soucoupes volantes, les Twin Towers, l'Atlantide, des miniatures du Manifeste des Sages de Sion, Elvis Presley, il m'en manque là, des Templiers, sûrement. Il y a sûrement des Templiers dans le coup. On peut faire tout ce qu'on veut avec. Amusez-vous.
Voilà, vous avez compris, cette conférence était un vaste complot, soit pour vous faire rester pour voir la prochaine conférence qui s'appelle Les mythes et la science-fiction, le retour, soit pour aller retrouver nos auteurs qui sont en dédicace tout de suite après, notamment avec aussi Jean-Claude Dugnac, Francis Valéry, Karine Rosenfeld et Hugo Bellagamba. Merci à tous.